Let's resume our study in Matthew chapter 20. At verse 24 is where we left off. The situation is that James and John, with their mother Salome, who is the aunt of Jesus because she's Mary's sister, they've engaged in a bit of a power play to try to secure the number one and two thrones in the kingdom for James and John, Jesus' cousins. And when this happened, Jesus kind of rebuffed them about it, that they weren't really understanding what they were asking for, and that it wasn't his place to determine who gets the number one and two spot in the kingdom. But the genie is out of the bottle, as we say. The 10 other apostles heard this interchange, and it ticked them off, as we would also say. Verse 24, when the 10 heard it, they were indignant at the two brothers. Now, I halfway jokingly say that one of the reasons they were mad was because they hadn't thought or didn't dare to try to make such a power play themselves. And so this causes Jesus to see the need to teach them servant leadership, which is a core component of the church administration. And I urge all of my fellow brother preachers to pay attention to what Jesus teaches here. We can't be doing power play leadership in the church. There's no place for it. We are not the bosses of the church of Christ. He's the one that died for it. He's the one that calls the shots. He's the head. We may be in places of responsibility, but we don't own the church. And I don't mean just simply in the larger church. I'm also talking about the local congregations. No power playing allowed. So this is what Jesus teaches on the topic. Let's take it to heart. Jesus called them to him. So basically, it's time now for a leadership conference. And he said, you know for a fact, probably from personal experience, that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. So they play hardball. They call in favors, or they hold grudges, and all of that stuff. And Jesus says, you know that's what they do. And then he says this, very important, verse 26, it shall not be so among you. No power playing in the church is what he says. Instead, this is the rule. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant. And whoever would be first among you must be your slave. In the church, we in leadership need to practice this sort of humility. We need to not demand our own way. We need to not give ultimatums. We need to not throw our weight around. Instead, we should be asking the question repeatedly, what can I do for you? What can I do to help? What can I do to make this work? What can I do to make things go smoothly for you and for the work of Jesus Christ? That is the proper mindset of anyone in leadership in the church. If you don't have that type of mindset, you don't belong in leadership in the church. And we need to exercise from church leadership anyone that has a self-centered, egotistical, my way or the highway type of attitude. The ultimate example of servant leadership is, of course, Jesus himself. And he says that here, verse 28, even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus had a lot of weight to throw around, and yet he did not use it. In fact, he exemplified what he taught in the last hours of his life. No greater love has any man than this, that he should lay down his life for his friends. We need to have that same sort of love for the people in our churches, in our congregations, that we would die for them. Because if you would die for someone, you are not going to slam on them. You are not going to kick them around and walk all over them and use them like a doormat. That is not part of church leadership lifestyle. And so I really encourage you to soak this up and put it into practice and to warn in a loving fashion anybody in church leadership that does not practice this, that they need to repent and get things right so that they can move forward. As we've been studying this, we know Jesus has been walking with the pilgrim crowds from Galilee toward Jerusalem. It's about a 3, maybe 4-day journey, depending on from where in Galilee you start. It comes down and bypasses Samaria by going across into Perea, and eventually in southern Perea, you get to the Roman road system that crosses the Jordan River westward and then goes up to the city of Jericho. Jericho is about 6 miles west of the Jordan riverbed. And as you approach, and you see it a good long ways away, having been there myself, it's interesting that you can see Jericho from the Jordan river banks. So as they're going and they come close to Jericho, they start running into crowds of people that are also involved in the Passover pilgrimage, but who have heard that Jesus is in the entourage. And so when we read next in Matthew 20, verse 29, it says it this way: as they came out of Jericho, a great crowd followed him. And behold, there were 2 blind men sitting by the roadside. And when they heard that Jesus was passing by, they cried out, "Lord, have mercy on us, Son of David." Now, Mark's account says pretty much the same sort of stuff. This is Mark 10:46. They came to Jericho, and as he was leaving Jericho with his disciples and a great crowd, Bartimaeus, a blind beggar, the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside. And when he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and say, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on us." So from those 2 parallel texts, we understand there were actually 2 blind men together, but we're going to focus on one of them in particular. He goes by the title Bartimaeus, which is just Aramaic for son of Timaeus. He was by the roadside as Jesus was leaving the city of Jericho, and he starts crying out for Jesus' mercy. So we've got all of that basic information. Now we come to Luke's account, and we have some tweaking that needs to happen. Verse 35 of Luke 18 says, "As he drew near to Jericho, a blind man was sitting by the roadside begging. And hearing a crowd going by, he inquired what this meant. And they told him, 'Jesus of Nazareth was passing by.' And he cried out, 'Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me.'" Now this passage in Luke has him approaching Jericho, while the other two have him leaving Jericho. And there has been this ongoing puzzle as to how all three passages could be true at the same time. And the guess that some have made is that even at this time in history, Jericho was made up of two areas. And that was really old Jericho and then the newer city of Jericho. And that what we see happening here is that Jesus is leaving one and passing through to the other. And I think that makes good sense. So we'll kind of go with that ideal. But the circumstances is that we've got all these pilgrim crowds passing through Jericho anyway, on their way to Jerusalem, and they're excited just by that. But the presence of Jesus in their particular entourage has really got the noise level up, the excitement level up. And when blind Bartimaeus and his buddy, who is unnamed for whatever reason, hear this extra loud sound, they're like, "What's going on?" And they're told it's Jesus of Nazareth, the prophet, the healer. And they together decide they want him to fix their issue. And they start yelling out for him. So let's continue in the Luke passage, since that's right where we're at. Those who were in front rebuked him, telling him to be silent. So he's yelling, and the people that are right in front of him don't like him yelling in their ear, probably. And they're like, "Shut up, don't be so loud, be quiet." But he cried out all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me, have mercy on us." And Jesus hears him, hears them. And so Jesus stopped right there in his tracks, and he commanded him to be brought to him. And we are told, let's see here, I'm trying to find out which one it was in, since we've got three different things. It looks like it's in Mark. Mark chapter 10, verse 49. Jesus stopped and said, "Call him," or "call them," because we know it's more than one. And they called the blind man, saying to him, "Take heart, get up, he's calling you." And throwing off his cloak, he sprang up and came to Jesus. Now that's an important bit of detail, because the cloak was very important. This is your outer layer of clothing, and it wasn't just simply an overcoat. It was also your sleeping bag at night. It was your covers whenever it came time for you to go to bed. And so he has thrown this off to the side and took off at whatever run he's able to do, being blind, and makes his way to Jesus, probably with the assistance of the people. And Jesus then said to him, "What do you want me to do for you?" Now, some people go, "Well, that's kind of a duh." But this is important. You need to express what's on your heart. We do this with kids, so I'm not sure why we don't understand it from adults. When children are hemming and hawing and they're not getting around to what the point is, we tell them, "You need to tell me what you want. You need to verbalize it. You need to say it out loud." We want people to confess it, to say it. And so that's what Jesus wants him to do, is say out loud exactly what he's looking for. And so the blind man said to him, "Rabbi, let me recover my sight." And so Jesus then said to him, "Go your way, your faith has made you well." The Matthew account says in Matthew 20, verse 34, that Jesus in pity touched their eyes, and immediately they recovered their sight and followed him. So Jesus has pity upon them, touches them, makes them well, tells them, you can now go your way because your faith made the difference here. Verbalizing your faith was important, but it was your faith that started this whole process. And what did these two guys do? They immediately joined the crowd. They joined the entourage. They travel with Jesus heading for Jerusalem. You know why that's important? Because as blind men, traveling would not have been all that easy. Going to Jerusalem, even there, they would not have been allowed to get into the inner area of the temple. Excuse me. As blind men, they would only be allowed to go as far as the court of the Gentiles. And all along the way, they'd have to deal with people like the Pharisees who taught that if you were blind, it's because you had a problem. You were a sinner. You had done something wrong. And so Jesus has fixed all that, and so these guys are now ready to go to Jerusalem, perhaps the first time in their lives, maybe the first time in a long time, in order to worship. And they're doing it as followers of Jesus. Luke's account slides into some new stories. So let's go to Luke 18, verse number 42, let's just start there as a kind of a overlap. Jesus said to him, recover your sight, your faith has made you well. And immediately he recovered his sight and followed him, glorifying God, giving praise to God. And all the people, when they saw it, gave praise to God. Now chapter 19 tells us that he entered Jericho and was passing through. Now, I'm going to throw in again another possibility here that maybe the events surrounding blind Bartimaeus started on one side of the Jericho metro area and finished on the far side of the Jericho metro area. That blind Bartimaeus and his buddy may have first heard all the noise on the east side, and realizing that Jesus would eventually have to come out the west side, that's where they station themselves. And so that the story that we just read took place after the events I'm about to read. That's another possible way of making a chronology harmony of this information between the three Gospels. But let's focus on what happened inside the city now. Verse 2. There was a man named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector. So he is way up in the independent contractor world. Tax revenue was collected by different levels of agents. And so he's way up there. We'd probably call him like a regional tax collector. And he was very rich. Now, he was seeking to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not because he was small of stature. So he was either a dwarf or a midget. He was a small person, and he could not have been able to see Jesus easily because of the crowd. And as you might suspect, because we've talked about Jewish attitudes toward tax collectors, nobody would have necessarily given him place for him to take a stand at the front of the route that Jesus is walking along. So what does he do? He ran on ahead, and he climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him. Now, this is not a sycamore like the sycamores we talk about here in the United States. This is a sycamore fig tree, and it has lower branches that you can climb up into, and then you can get a little bit farther up. They kind of spread out really far laterally. So he gets up into one of these trees and manages to get out onto one of these branches far enough that he can see the path that Jesus is coming along. When Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, which was the first miraculous thing, that he would know this man by name. And he calls him by name to really get his attention. Then he says this, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today. Now, this is not the evening. This is the middle of the day. And so it is common practice to kind of take a break in the travel in the middle of the day to kind of stay out of the heat of the day and have a meal break. And so Jesus just invited himself to lunch with this guy. Now, the guy loves it. He is excited by this because what does he know? He knows about Jesus. He is plugged in. He knows all the news. He knows that Jesus is a healer and a teacher, a great prophet, perhaps even the Messiah. And that's why he wanted to see him. And now, not only did he see him, he has the opportunity to have a meal with him. So he hurried down. He came down and received him joyfully. The received him, meaning he invited him to come in for lunch. And when they, meaning the crowd, saw it, they all grumbled. He's gone to be the guest of a man who is a sinner. Because everybody assumed if you were a tax collector, you were a cheat. I am repeatedly puzzled that we still have this same sort of widespread attitude that is expressed toward IRS agents today. I confess to you that I have no problem believing the vast majority of people who work in the IRS are perfectly legitimate, hardworking, honest people. Yes, there's probably some cheats, because that's true in most businesses. But even though I know that to be the case, I hear people talk down about IRS agents all the time. They treat them as if they were Satan incarnate. Well, that's pretty much the attitude that the Jewish people had toward these tax revenue agents. And so they treated them as if they were lost, which is most unfortunate because probably a lot of them were very religious people. In fact, I was reading the other day in Josephus, and one of the tax collectors was responsible for paying to build a synagogue and to secure holy documents, the holy scrolls for the synagogue. He was a very religious person. So we don't know what Zacchaeus's background is along that line other than what we're told here. Because at the meal, this is what happens. Verse number 8. Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, Behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor. So he voluntarily says, I'm going to take half of my wealth and donate it to the poor people. That's a pretty righteous thing to do. And then he says this, and the way that it's framed, it is that he didn't believe that he had defrauded anyone, but if he had, this is what he was going to do. If I have defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold. That's according to Jewish law. If you had taken something from someone and you couldn't give back the exact thing, then once you did figure out how much you had taken, you gave four times as much to that person in value. So Zacchaeus says, Jesus, I'm telling you right now, I'm going to give half of my wealth to the poor, and I'm going to go back over my records, and if I find out that I've cheated anybody, I'm going to pay back to them four times what I cheated them. And Jesus' response is this. Jesus said to him, today, salvation has come to this house, since he is also a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. Now that's a sermon for the other people. That even this man here, a tax collector that everybody assumed was a horrible sinner, that he can be saved. And that Jesus is here to save everyone. And we need, folks, to get that very clearly ingrained in our own Christian brains today. That everyone that we come across, regardless of what they look like, sound like, smell like, regardless of what job they might have, regardless of what their education level or ethnicity, no matter what they do, say, or are, they are somebody that Jesus died for. And if Jesus wants them saved, we should want them saved too. And we should bend over backwards to try to help them come to relationship with him. And so let's get out there and not just be hearers of the word, but be doers as well. Now we've only got enough time to introduce the parable that Jesus tells next. As they heard these things, he proceeded to tell a parable because he was near to Jerusalem and because they supposed that the kingdom of God was to appear immediately. This is something I've told you. A lot of these folks think they're living in the time when everything's going to get wrapped up. And so Jesus decides he needs to tell them a parable about a king that goes away for a while and then comes back. And what he expects his people to be doing while he's gone.